From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There is a theme implicit in George Packer's new book. It's called The Unwinding, and the idea is the institutions the middle class has relied on for so long, the farms, the factories, the schools, have collapsed. Unwinding refers to what Packer calls that coil that held Americans together and has now begun to unwind. So that's the theme, but his book, as he points out, is not an argument. It's not an explicit assessment of any of these ideas. It's a portrait. Packer's book is a collection of stories, the son of tobacco farmers, a factory worker, a Washington insider, all of them trying to find some support since the structures they've always counted on, Packer says, have collapsed like pillars of salt. The Unwinding, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. George Packer is our guest today. He's written a book called The Unwinding, which is the term he uses to describe the way the structures that shored up the middle class have broken down, uncoiled, over the last 30 years or so. So the theme of the book is that there is this bond that we all share that has come undone. And Packer points out this has happened before. Other generations have adapted to it, rebuilt the structure, and so there's the question of whether we can too. But George Packer has also pointed out his book is not an argument. It gets at the theme through these portraits, through the stories of ordinary Americans, though he also includes some extraordinary people in there, too, for contrast and comparison. The book is about the ordinary people, though, the portraits of them, people who have been left to improvise their way around the unwinding. George Packer's joining us to talk about it today, the book The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. George Packer is, of course, a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, the author of a number of books, among them Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And George Packer, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Very glad to be with you.
I guess I wanted to begin with the question of whether or not it's at all difficult in some way to talk about the book, in the sense that, as I mentioned, you do write a prologue that sort of lays down some of the basic themes, but it's not a first-person account in the sense that it's not really this explicit assessment of the unwinding. You want the stories to sort of speak for themselves, so I'm wondering if that makes it difficult to talk about when you're doing, you know, radio interviews like this.
It does a bit. You're right. There's no first person in the book at all, which was a complete departure for me in nonfiction writing. In a way, it was a reversion to something I did 15, 20 years ago when I wrote two novels, which were in the third person. And this is a more novelistic work of nonfiction than any I've ever written. And that means it should speak for itself, and it has to. And the themes that you very cogently outlined are there, but they're there by implication and indirection. The book is a generation-long narrative of America told through the stories that you mentioned as the reader moves back and forth in between them,
right,
and moves forward in time from the late 70s to the present. And the book has to work on that level. It has to absorb the reader in these lives and in the picture that begins to build of the larger country through these smaller storylines. And that should raise all kinds of questions and produce all sorts of thoughts and reactions. And there's no point in the book at which I say, here's what it's about, here's the problem, here's the solution. And in interviews, inevitably, the conversation turns in that direction. And I'm happy to take it in that direction to a certain degree, but I always want to pull it back to what's in the book, because that's what matters to me and that's what should matter to the reader.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the kind of narrative structure of the book. I mean, there are these – you include in these stream of consciousness fragments, these kind of time posts that move us through the arc, but then the portraits themselves, and I guess, I mean, it's an homage in some ways to John Dos Passos. That's a form that he's written with. It's been called the camera eye, I guess. Were you thinking a lot about that form?
Well, in Dos Passos USA trilogy, the camera eye is one of four narrative modes, and that's actually the one I don't emulate here. That's a very much a first-person, subjective, impressionistic, kind of Joycean stream of consciousness. But I turned to Dos Passos not so much to salute him as to grab a lifeline, because I had all this material, and I knew it was all gathered around this central concern about how America has lost its sense of a social contract in this generation, but I didn't know how to put it together, and the structure didn't come to me until I began to write, which is actually very late in the process, for me at least, and was a source of some panic. And then my wife reminded me that at the very start, before I'd even gone out and done the first interviews, I had said, I'd like to try a nonfiction version of USA to get at America more artfully and indirectly than journalism usually allows you to do. But then I put it aside thinking, that would never work. It's too hard. It'd be too difficult to get into these characters' lives that way.
Right.
And she said, why not try that? Why not do something you've never done before? And I thought, well, it's about time. I've written a few books. I've been at The New Yorker for 10 years. I've learned how to do things that way. Maybe it's time to experiment and see what happens. So Dos Passos was there as a kind of guide, although you can't really follow it too closely because that's fiction. This is nonfiction. That was a different time. It had already been done before.
Yeah. So when you were, I mean, a lot of us became familiar with some of these stories in The New Yorker itself, these portraits. Did you, when you were writing them, did you see them as part of the bigger theme at that point? Did you realize you would collect them later as part of that more implicit theme?
Well, really only about, I'd say, 20% of the book appeared in The New Yorker.
Yeah.
And the part that did appear, I had really deliberately pursued for the book. And then The New Yorker became a vehicle for it and accommodated it. But Jeff Connaughton, for example, the Washington insider in the book, I had written that completely for the book, and then it was sort of compressed and turned into a profile in The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. Same with a couple of the other passages or stories that appeared in the New Yorker. But I think the main work of the book, the two other central characters, Dean Price and Tammy Thomas, and then the 10 portraits of famous people, that was all original material and didn't appear in the magazine.
Mm. So how did you, maybe this is not quite the way to put it, but how did you cast the characters, I guess? I mean, how did you find them, and what were you looking for in particular as you were looking for the portraits, or is that how it worked?
Yeah, I think cast them is a good metaphor, although it was more accidental than that, at least at the beginning. I had in mind a book about this institutional breakdown and how it affects people in different parts of the country, and I felt I should go to both the power centers and the success stories like Wall Street and Silicon Valley and Washington, and the places that have been more left behind, like the Rust Belt and the rural South, some of the Sun Belt exurbs that began to fall apart with the housing bust, and that turned out to be Tampa in my book. So I ran across Dean Price as the first person who became a character in the book, and I talk about them as characters, but it leaves me a little uneasy because they are, after all, real people.
Yeah.
I met Dean while working on a different New Yorker piece, and within 30 seconds of hearing him talk on the phone, and as we go on, I can tell you what he was talking about in his story, I just thought, this guy is magnetic. He's got an incredible voice. He's exciting. He has a vision. He comes from a very different part of the country than me. And I told him, stop. Just don't squander it.
Right.
I'm afraid if you keep talking, you'll never do it again this well. So I'm going to come down and meet you. And I did, and kept going down over and over, really 6 or 8 times, to rural North Carolina, Rockingham County, North Carolina, where Dean lives. Stayed at his house, met his family, traveled around with him, just really got to know his life and his quest quite intimately, and heard him give that talk 100 times. And it was exciting every time. He knew how to make it that way. And he became the sort of the central spine of the book, his story. Others, Jeff Connaughton, the Washington insider, and Tammy Thomas, the factory worker turned community organizer in Youngstown, Ohio, I pursued a little more deliberately. I wanted a Washington story because Washington's so central to what's happened in the country over the past generation. Mm-hmm. And I wanted a Rust Belt story because deindustrialization has been this vast event affecting millions of people that we hardly even think about anymore. And I thought that a woman's story from the Rust Belt would be particularly interesting. So I sort of sought them out with a little bit more consciousness that I wanted to fill in the portrait through characters like these.
Well, let's start with Tammy, if that's okay. That's not how you actually begin in the book. As you mentioned, you start with Dean, but we'll come back to him. Tammy Thomas, as you say, from Youngstown, Ohio. In Ohio for more than 50 years, you talk about these steel mills and the city's industrial families prospering. And then 1977, the mills start to close. Tammy's 11 when this started to happen. And I guess we should say something about the late 70s. 1978 is kind of the time peg that you use. But it's 77, 78, right around that time. Was that a crucial time?
A lot of things happened. Yeah.
A lot of things happened in that era. Say something about that time. Did you set that as a peg, or did you just find that emerging through these stories?
I felt the book needed a point of departure, a beginning.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned earlier, there are these collages or mashups that string together song lyrics and newspaper headlines and ad slogans and quotes, speeches from certain key years along the way as the reader moves through the book. And the first one is 1978. I think 78 is when you can see the early signs of what I call the unwinding.
Yeah.
For example, you see the first real blows of deindustrialization in a place like Youngstown, where the steel mills start to close and then it happens so fast it's breathtaking. Mm. You can see the business sector in Washington starting to organize itself as a really powerful lobby and pursuing its interests much more aggressively than it did in the previous decade or two, and lobbying and defeating a series of bills that were very important to labor and to consumers, even though both houses of Congress were controlled by the Democrats, as was the White House, business becomes a real political force right around this time. You can also see, and the tax revolt starts in 78 with Proposition 13 in California. That was the year I graduated from high school. So I got out of the California public schools. I went to school in Palo Alto, California. I got out just before the tax revolt began, the erosion of funding for schools in California. And the information age really starts to become popularized in the late 70s with the Apple II computer and the beginning of Microsoft. So a lot of things that now are with us as if they've always been there begin to show themselves right around that time, and a little arbitrarily, but not completely. I felt I needed a particular year, and that became 1978.
Mm. I want to have you read a section, if you would, one of the sections of with Tammy Thomas. How did you find her, Tammy?
I started asking people who knew the sort of labor and community organizing world of Ohio, actually of the Midwest more broadly, if they knew a woman in a Rust Belt city who had an interesting story and who was doing something to try to revive, you know, the collapse of her community. And a few names came across my screen, and then came this name, Tammy Thomas, and I looked her up, and there was very little information about her on the web. But what interested me was she had actually been a factory worker for 20 years before becoming a community organizer, and had lived her whole life in Youngstown and remembered the closing of the mills. So she had lived it. And so I went out to see her. She was willing to be interviewed by me, and I ended up spending quite a bit of 2 weeks with her. And it was a far deeper and more powerful and disturbing and also inspiring story than I ever imagined. So in that sense, I think I got lucky in finding Tammy Thomas, and it was very late in the process of reporting this book. She was raised by a mother who had a heroin addiction. And in fact, Tammy, I'd say, took care of her mother at least as much as her mother took care of Tammy. The real formative person in her life was her great-grandmother, right, who worked as a maid in the homes of wealthy white people and would take Tammy to their homes while she was working. And that great-grandmother gave Tammy a sense of responsibility and of ambition, which stood her in good stead at very critical moments in her life when things started to fall apart. Mm.
Read this section, if you would.
Tammy was 11 when the mills started closing. She was too young to know or care about Steel Town, the historic strikes, deindustrialization, or the specter of a whole city's ruin. She had her hands full surviving her own life. The year after Black Monday, she moved back with her mother and stepfather to the East Side. Officially, she lived with them in a house on Bruce Street, but in fact she was staying with Granny again on Charlotte. The summer after she returned, their front door was stolen. It was a solid oak antique with a glass oval, along with the ornamental cut-glass windows that surrounded it. A few of their neighbors' houses got hit by the same thieves. Granny couldn't afford to replace it, so they boarded up the front door, and for several years they went in and out of the back door. There were times when Tammy was too embarrassed to have friends visit. The theft of the door marked a turning point that she would often refer to in later years, a sign that the family's struggles were becoming part of something larger. The mob no longer had control of the streets, even though Syrax wasn't far from Charlotte Avenue, and the neighborhood was getting bad. By the mid-70s, most of the white families had moved out of the East Side, and Black Monday finished the exit. When Miss Sybil had graduated from East High School in 1964, the majority of the student body was white, and after her class elected a black girl as homecoming queen, a white teacher overruled the vote, saying, "It's not time yet." But with every year of the 70s, Tammy's class photo had one or two fewer white kids, until by the time she entered high school in 1980, East was almost all black and Puerto Rican. The high school was within walking distance of Charlotte Avenue, but in ninth grade, Tammy was bused to Wilson High on the south side for racial balance. Her best friend Gwen was the only other black kid in math class, and the teacher would totally ignore them when they had their hands up. She missed being at a predominantly black school, so in 10th grade, she transferred to East. She took on bigger responsibilities at home, learning to do simple repairs, taking the bus to shop for groceries and pay the bills. Eventually, Granny turned over ownership of the house to her with a quitclaim deed. The roles were reversed. Now she was taking care of Granny. And then when she was 15, she got pregnant.
Which breaks her great-grandmother's heart, of course. But she, you know, she goes ahead. I mean, the story is she finishes high school. She gets a diploma, gets an associate's degree at a technical college, gets off welfare, becomes a factory worker.
Yeah, she defies all the usual storylines of someone whose life begins that way.
It's interesting also how you weave in sort of the diminishing power of the labor unions into Tammy's story.
Yeah, that's something she felt keenly. I mean, Youngstown was a real labor town. The little steel strike of 1937 was when the smaller steel companies, not U.S. Steel, but Republic and Youngstown Sheet and Tube, the workers went on strike as they were being organized by what became the United Steelworkers Union. And there were people killed. It was a violent strike and violent. It was put down violently. And it led to the unionization of the whole steel industry in Youngstown and elsewhere. And that was what was there when Tammy was a little girl. By the time she went to work, not at a steel mill because there really were none left, but at a GM auto parts factory outside Youngstown, the union was really back on its heels and was simply trying to negotiate one round of, you know, sort of a three-tiered wage system that favored the older workers and not the younger, and then buyouts and the company moving a lot of the equipment and the jobs to Mexico. And the shop, the union stewards just didn't seem all that interested in solving the problems of line workers like Tammy. And so That was one among several institutions, you know, corporations, government, the newspaper, the churches, that had been really the mainstay of the working class in Youngstown, and that stopped working and left people really on their own in a place that even physically looked as if people were alone, because you have a city that once had a 250,000 people down to 70,000, sort of Detroit on a small scale, and it looks empty because there just aren't enough people in it, and the houses are vacant or else the lots are vacant.
Another thing that emerges in the book as the stories sort of play out is this idea that you have these institutions that start to break these taboos. You have these certain kinds of taboos, you know, for banking institutions to start to create these products that they knew weren't sustainable. That was a taboo, but they start to do it little by little. And then corporate leaders who lay off, you know, these huge swaths of a workforce, which they wouldn't have done, they come to be really proud of it. And it seems like the thing that's missing, you go back to that social contract, that things that weren't done before that are being done now is kind of stripping out that social contract part, that human component, I guess.
Right, and this is one reason why I thought a narrative book would be a better way to create this portrait than another book discussing changing social policy and changing politics and laws, because we're familiar with that. We know about the deregulation of the financial sector. We know about how the tax code became less progressive under Reagan, et cetera. But what I wanted to convey was the feeling of it, of individuals and their relations to each other and how they changed. And it happens, you know, on a very basic moral level, where, you know, Tammy Thomas's company, Packard Electric, which then gets turned into Delphi, and which then gets turned into DLPM Holding, once it is just a shell of itself and is essentially an investment vehicle for Wall Street. Its loyalty to the workers, which did exist to some extent, starts to thin out. And once those taboos are broken, the ones you mentioned, it's really hard to put them back, because people feel that they have to do what everyone else is doing in order to compete, and that they'll look foolish or their shareholders will vote them out or whatever the case. And it isn't just a matter of changing laws or even changing forces of globalization. It's a matter of what people are willing to do and how far they're willing to push against the bonds that hold together a place like Youngstown. And they turn out to be quite fragile.
George Packer is with us, staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest book is called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. You can join us, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, George Packer is our guest to talk about his new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Packer says there's a bond, a social contract between us all that is coming undone, and the void, he says, is being filled by a society of organized money. You can join us, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Packer tells the stories of four average citizens, one average city, which he contrasts with the stories of famous Americans who built their fortunes on selling us the promises of prosperity and convenience. And George Packer, let me ask you about that. We'll get back to Dean Price and Jeff Connaughton here in a moment, but I wanted to ask about the portraits of people like Oprah Winfrey and Newt Gingrich, and are these contrast pieces in some ways? What do they represent in the bigger scheme?
Right, that's a good question. The first thing they represent is the different areas of our common life. Gingrich comes from politics. Yeah. And I think more than any other figure of this past generation, which is where the period of the unwinding, he has shaped the political discourse and atmosphere and norms that we are so familiar with, so abysmally familiar with today. Sam Walton comes from business, and I think the empire he founded, Walmart, represents sort of the cheapening of the American economy, pushing manufacturing out and bringing retail in and turning us into consumers rather than makers. Jay-Z is from the world of entertainment, and he's a rags-to-riches story unlike any other, from the Brooklyn housing projects to, you know, to the very top of the heap, but really with an ethos of win at all costs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't even ask for forgiveness later. Success justifies itself. A lot of them come from similar backgrounds to the main characters, the unknown characters. Sam Walton comes from a small town in the South, rather like Dean Price, and has dreams of being an entrepreneur just like Dean Price. Right.
Greg Gingrich is very much like Jeff Connaughton.
Newt Gingrich comes from a lower middle class Pennsylvania town and has dreams of, you know, Washington, both glory and also idealism, mm-hmm. A desire to really work to better the country from a young age. As Jeff Connaughton comes from a small town in Alabama, relatively small, and is also from middle class, lower middle class background. And it's a little hard to compare Tammy Thomas and Oprah Winfrey too carefully, but they both had a very, very tough early time, and all the odds were against them. I guess one thing that you see in the portraits of these celebrities is this: once there's a rise in a society without solid institutions, is this urge to build it all yourself and to create out of your own success an empire. So you see a pattern in almost all the stories of famous Americans of a kind of self-invention, maybe even a creation myth or, a legend about the early years. And then it rises and expands to the point of being just a huge empire, and you can't stop growing or else you'll die. But inevitably, in many of the cases, decadence sets in because the language becomes a parody of itself, and the life of the celebrities becomes this self-enclosed superclass that is cut off from the life of the country. So I wanted to both see what was taking the place of the institutions, mm-hmm. these individuals who were not building them up so much as either pushing them aside or taking them over or disrupting them, as they say in Silicon Valley, and also what happens to someone from a humble background when they get as big as Sam Walton or Oprah Winfrey or Newt Gingrich gets.
Mm. Raymond Carver is interesting. I mean, you write about how Carver's characters spoke a language that sounded ordinary, except, as you say, every word echoed with the strange. These were lives trembling over a void. Talk about Raymond Carver, because he concentrates in some ways. I kept seeing him connected to you in the sense that he's concentrating, as you put it in the book, on these lives of these marginal lost people. In some ways, that's what you've done.
Yeah, I included him very late in the writing because I felt there needed to be more people from the top, although he never had a lot of money, but he became, you know, one of the most revered fiction writers of my lifetime, mm-hmm. who had really achieved something and who showed, by contrast to the noisier empire builders I was describing earlier, just what can be gained from faithful attention to a craft, mm-hmm. and to doing something really good, shutting out the noise. And that's the very end of the Carver chapter, is that in that he did something that in the American din was a very big thing, even though it seems small, which is to say just trying to listen to the voices in his head and render them with as much faithfulness and art as he could. Obviously, that's what every writer wants to do. And Carver did it in a way that almost anticipated some of the lives in the book. He, you know, he really was writing in the 60s and 70s for the most part, but unlike the more flamboyant writers of that period, he seemed attuned to people whose lives were quieter and more desperate than in the novels of, say, Philip Roth or John Updike. And that made him in some ways a voice of the unwinding, even though he died very early on in the period of the book.
What did you find? Let's talk about Dean Price. You mentioned in the book, you describe his greatest fears in his life, poverty and failure, but he came by them naturally, raised in Madison, North Carolina. And it's interesting, you've talked about going through, I don't know if it was Main Street, but Madison's downtown. I mean, the physical structures there that were just really decrepit and had actually collapsed.
Yeah. Dean comes from the old textile and tobacco country of North Carolina, which had been the mainstays of life and had created not wealth, but except for the owners, but a really sustainable middle-class life or working-class life for mill workers and for tobacco farmers, and a certain amount of independence, especially for the tobacco farmers. His family had been farming tobacco in this little area of Rockingham County, North Carolina, for centuries. Mm. It's a very old place. It's a very conservative place. Tradition is strong there. Dean's father was a fire and brimstone preacher who failed as a preacher, ended up committing suicide. And his shadow really cast itself over Dean's whole life. And Dean was determined not to be pulled down in the same way as his father. And he wanted to be an entrepreneur. That was his dream of independence and also of wealth. And he tried to do it while his region was falling apart because textile mills were shutting down and tobacco was ending and the farms were turning fallow. He opened a chain of truck stops along a stretch of US 220 between Greensboro, North Carolina, and Martinsville, Virginia, with fast food restaurants and convenience stores, and found that he couldn't compete against Walmart and Sheets Oil and other multinational companies. He kept getting hogtied, as he put it. The little guy was hogtied. And eventually he found with the financial crisis, his businesses began to collapse and they kind of toppled each other like dominoes. By then he was on the cusp of a new idea, which had come to him in the midst of Hurricane Katrina. And that was that he could revive, he could make his own fortune and also sort of resurrect the fallen state of rural North Carolina with alternative energy, with biodiesel, and that the seeds of it were literally around him. Canola, soy, waste oil from all the restaurants and fast food joints. And that became his vision. I mean, a really religious quest in which he had just intense faith, and he needed it because he kept getting pushed back and knocked down. He went bankrupt twice. He went through some very dark times and kept getting turned down by county commissioners and other politicians. It was very hard to persuade people of this vision, but it began to take. And he's just a great story of American tenacity and dreaminess and perhaps a little bit of illusion and faith in the self. And he's just a wonderful man and a very American story.
He's a lovely guy. And there's a section you write about. There are a number of these kind of epiphanies that come to him, or these turning points. I mean, there's this moment in the late 90s you write about where he finds himself reading the self-help book. This is a book called Think and Grow Rich by a man named Napoleon Hill. This is really interesting in terms of explaining who Dean is, because you say that from Napoleon Hill, he learns that there's this kind of magical power in your mind. Talk about that influence on his life.
Yeah, Napoleon Hill was a sort of the original How to Succeed in Business writer. Yeah. From the early 20th century, he was set about by Andrew Carnegie to talk to all the leaders of the early 20th century, which is a period not unlike the one we're in now. And so he went from Henry Ford to John D. Rockefeller to Theodore Roosevelt and codified their success stories in two books, The Law of Success and Think and Grow Rich. And these became really hugely influential, sold millions of copies, and are very much in the American grain of if you can think it and believe it, you can do it, which goes back to Emersonian self-reliance and goes forward to Oprah's, you know, kind of new age positive thinking. And Dean is a real believer in the philosophy of Napoleon Hill. He can quote him as much as he can quote the Bible. And it has sustained Dean through many, many setbacks.
So he has, Dean, this peak oil and Hurricane Katrina kind of come to Jesus moments, which give him this epiphany about biofuel. And at some point, I want to have you read this section, because at some point he has this nightmarish vision where the fast food franchise Bojangles comes, as you say in the book, to represent everything that was wrong with the way Americans lived. Do you need to set anything up to read this section?
Yeah, I think just to say that this is the point where he's on the cusp of moving away from fast food and number two diesel and imported oil and embracing a vision of the countryside being filled with local producers, people making their own food, making their own energy. He has this idea that just as in the 19th century, the rivers were dotted with grist mills every 50 miles, today the highways, or tomorrow the highways, will be dotted with biodiesel refineries every 50 miles, and that this will bring back the economy and the moral fiber of his part of the country. And so real, you know, the word epiphany is a good one, because he's a man whose life is a series of insights and quests, and it's very much tied up with a religious view of life. So this is him at that moment when he's begun to be disillusioned with the entrepreneurial scheme he had to open these truck stops, but doesn't quite know what to do next. He was seeing beyond the surfaces of the land to its hidden truths. Some nights he sat up late on his front porch with a glass of Jack and listened to the trucks heading south on 220, carrying crates of live chickens to the slaughterhouses, always under cover of darkness like a vast and shameful trafficking. Chickens pumped full of hormones that left them too big to walk. And he thought how these same chickens might return from their destination as pieces of meat to his floodlit Bojangles up the hill from his house, and that meat would be drowned in the bubbling fryers by employees whose hatred of the job would leak into the cooked food, and that food would be served up and eaten by customers who would grow obese and end up in the hospital in Greensboro with diabetes or heart failure, a burden to the public. And later, Dean would see them riding around the Mayodan Walmart in electric carts because they were too heavy to walk the aisles of a supercenter, just like hormone-fed chickens. The traffic on 220, the lifeblood of his chain, made him think about all those engines burning all those millions of gallons of gas that came from America's enemies overseas, and the millions of dollars leaking out of the local economy to the oil companies and big-box retailers. He would pull his truck into a Marathon gas station to fill up and notice the logo above the pump with the words, "All roads lead to liberty," written across a flag in the shape of the U.S. map. And it would make him a little crazy to think of people around here buying into such hypocritical bullshit. They'd grown dependent on the corporations and lost their independent spirit. They were supposed to be Americans, not Americaints. But democracy was in one of those stages of decline. It would take something big to rouse people in the Piedmont and make them act, something as big as peak oil, which, in Dean's opinion, was the biggest thing in the 21st century. The age of cheap energy had begun when Colonel Edwin Drake drilled the first oil well in 1859 in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and it had created the greatest industrial power the world had ever known, and now it was coming to an end.
George Packer, reading from his book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. We'll take another brief break. We'll be back in a minute. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with George Packer. We're talking about his new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. You point out in the book that this unwinding isn't really new. You say we seem to have them every generation or two. You mention the time after the country's founding when these quarrelsome factions start to emerge. And then there's the Civil War. It was kind of an unwinding. Then there's, I think, the Great Depression is one. So I was wondering, what are the characteristics of an unwinding? I'm trying to see the common themes in all of these. Seems like one of them is, which seems ironic in some ways, but this sense of freedom.
Yeah. It's when old ways that used to work and that used to hold a society together have, for various reasons, either eroded or unraveled or just come flying apart. And suddenly everyone is restless and on the move, and life is changing quickly, and people are free in a way that they weren't. And in America, it's a frightening amount of freedom. I mean, we covet it, we cherish it, but it also leaves us quite alone on this landscape because we are such a mobile and fast-changing society, and there is so little that's permanent or that feels permanent. So it can be really quite disruptive and tumultuous when it happens, and it can be violent too. Like the Civil War is the single greatest instance of that. What we're going through today feels something like something a little bit more long term. And I've been asked, is this decline? Is this the empire on its way into the sunset? And I can't answer that. I don't see myself as a real pundit or a prognosticator, but I certainly hope it's not terminal decline. And in the past, there have always been these ways in which Americans have reinvented the social contract so that, you know, the states that were just disintegrating bloodily in the 1860s found a way back together. And it was an unjust way because it was built on racism and on Jim Crow. But it pulled the country together enough for prosperity to begin to grow in cities and in the industrial areas of the country. And then when that reached its reckoning with the Wall Street crash of 1929, which, you know, really ended a whole way of life, the New Deal and the post-war institutions and sort of business, labor, government ethos created a new social contract, and it was one in which the ties were much stronger and where ordinary people were sort of at the center of life. It was no longer a country of robber barons and wage slaves. It was a country of everymen and everywomen, and that was the period I call in the book the Roosevelt Republic, which I think lasted until the period when the unwinding begins in the late 70s. So it's cyclical. And I don't know that this time it has to be terminal. And I think there's a incredible resourcefulness and almost bottomless ability of Americans to come up with crazy new solutions that might seem preposterous at first and then end up pointing in a new direction. I just don't see it right now. And maybe we can't see it because we're in the middle of it.
Mm. Let's talk about Jeff Connaughton. Jeff, short, sandy-haired, smart, hardworking, lifelong inferiority complex, you say. He's from Alabama. Deep affection, of course, for politics, drawn to public service and to power. And this is how you describe him in the book, that he's that overlooked and necessary thing in the annals of Washington, where he ended up. Not Hamlet, but Rosencrantz. Not a principal, but a follower.
And Washington is full of Rosencrantzes, and indeed, it works because of the Rosencrantzes.
You know, yeah.
what we read about, you know, senators giving a speech and casting a vote, et cetera, is almost, you know, the afterthought in Washington. What really matters is all the work that the staffers are doing on legislation and on speech writing and on the negotiations among senators that go on in committees and outside committees all the time, maybe more dysfunctionally now than at any time in the last 100 or 150 years. So Jeff Conanton went to Washington to work for Joe Biden in the 80s. He saw Biden as really an heir to the Kennedys and was dazzled by his speaking and his intelligence and the clarity. And then, you know, of course, Biden's first presidential campaign ended badly with scandal. And Conanton stuck around because he still wanted to make a career in Washington. He wondered if he would get to the White House, which was his highest aim, but he still wanted to make a difference as a public servant and also to realize certain ambitions. But it turned out that Joe Biden was not a very good boss to work for. And gradually, Conanton became disillusioned with him. It turned out to be a very Washington relationship, very transactional. Biden was not loyal to Conanton, and Conanton, you know, in his service to Biden, fundraising and doing other things, sort of felt that he was overlooked, and so he turned elsewhere. First to the Clinton White House, where he had a short stint, and then to lobbying. And it was in lobbying that he had his great success. He went to work for one of Washington's biggest firms, Quinn Gillespie, which is a rare kind of breakthrough lobbying firm that had both Republicans and Democrats, which is not at all the norm. So that it didn't matter if Gore or Bush won the election in 2000, Quinn Gillespie was going to do fine, in fact, very well. And Conanton was the third of the three principals in that firm, and he did very well, made a lot of money, got to do things and have more responsibilities than he ever did in the public sector. And then, you know, certain turns happened in him. He began to wonder if you know, lobbying was really helping the public interest. And the 2008 financial crisis, in which he lost a lot of the money that he'd made and saw how much of Washington was in the hands of Wall Street, was a real reckoning for him. I think that moment of 2008 is the reckoning point for all the characters in the book. Everyone's life kind of building toward that crisis and then falling off from it in the second half of the book. And what Conanton did after the financial crisis was to go back into government under Ted Kaufman, who took Biden's Delaware Senate seat when Biden became vice president. And together, Kaufman and Conanton did what is almost unheard of in Washington. They decided, the hell with campaign money, the hell with lobbyists. We are going to try to write serious legislation that will regulate Wall Street again, to break up the big banks, to reinstate Glass-Steagall, which separated commercial investment banking, to do all these things that they felt needed to be done in order to prevent another crash and crisis like in 2008. And, you know, we know that story didn't end up the way Kaufman and Conanton wanted it to, but it was such an unusual thing to have public servants acting without regard to the consequences for them and as both politicians and as potential workers in the private sector. In other words, they were freed from the burden of having to make people with a lot of money happy, and that allowed them to really act like public servants for a couple of years.
You know, we don't have time to have you read this last section, but I want to talk about the story. Jeff is deciding whether to leave Washington, and you talk about how one day he's channel flipping and Glenn Beck, of all people, comes on. And he was doing that thing in Washington where he's talking about how, you know, I can't remember that Beck had that big gathering on the Mall, and he was talking about how change didn't come from Washington. Now, Jeff Conanton doesn't think much of Glenn Beck, but the idea did resonate with him, this idea that change comes from a real place. And he realizes that that sentiment is true. And as you write about in the book, he sells his Georgetown townhouse and he ditches the place in a single day.
And he ditches Washington,
yep.
And he makes himself unemployable by beginning to say what he has seen and
yeah.
what he believes. And it's a very rare thing for an insider in Washington to become a defector and to start telling the truth. And that's what Connaughton has done and allowed me to do through him in this book. And in a way, his story ends and the book ends without much faith in the big power centers that used to control the big decisions, Washington, Wall Street, and we haven't talked about Silicon Valley, but that has a big
yeah.
role in the book as
Very
well.
Much.
And instead, you know, if there's going to be some bubbling up of imagination and improvisation and change, it's going to happen in places we haven't heard of and with people we haven't heard of and who I've tried to portray in the book, because in the midst of all this coming apart and dissolution, there are these glimmers of hope, which is Americans and their inextinguishable voices and their continued investment in the American dream, whether or not it continues to be invested in them.
Mm. You know, we're about out of time, but you know, I have to say I'm rooting for Dean to break through. I'm rooting for them all. You know, he doesn't have, as you've put, the same structures, but can he adapt? You know, and make it. And I guess you're sort of left rooting for them, which is great.
I am too. And I felt quite privileged to get to hang out with them and write about them and weave their story into the largest story of The Unwinding.
George Packer, The Unwinding is his book, An Inner History of the New America. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. George Packer, thanks very much.
I enjoyed it.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bompard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.